Just a review of the entire path of practice for a moment. The Bodhisattva path, the way to live for the benefit of all beings and find that free way of life for ourselves and others. The six paramitas, maybe everybody knows. But more and more I feel that these six bodhisattva practices really are the entirety of the path. If we just practice these six ways, nothing else is needed. It's all-encompassing. And it's a very like well-rounded model of the path. Paramita means literally to cross over or to go beyond. Sometimes we translate it as perfection, and that has one quality. I was contemplating different ways we might translate or talk about paramita, and one of the words that came up is bridge, because a bridge crosses over. We're talking about crossing over from our limited, constricted sense of self to the inconceivable vastness and non-separation of all beings. That's the crossing over we're talking about. So how about six bridges? Six bodhisattva bridges that are we can build to cross over ourselves and to carry all beings across. Bridges from this little limited location over the vast ocean of samsara into the bright mist. We don't know what's at the other end. The bright mist with rainbows all emerging from it. The mystery. Crossing over from our known limited version of ourselves and the world to vast openness. And I've been thinking that the first three seem to be kind of what we might call informal practice, and the second three maybe more like formal practice. I'm kind of just like, I haven't heard these things, but it seems this is one way we could look at it. That our Zen practice has an informal side that's like our everyday life in the world, and a formal side, meaning like has some form to it, has some forms and structures. Like today is like a formal event to do a one-day sitting with a schedule and a certain way to sit and bow. It's a so-called formal practice. There's a lot of overlap between formal and informal, of course, and between these six bridges for crossing over. But the first three of giving, the bodhisattva practices of giving or generosity, giving, material giving, dharma giving, fearlessness giving, giving ourselves to others, giving ourselves to ourselves, giving others to others, giving the world to the world. That's a practice we could do all day long. Doesn't require any particular form. The second bodhisattva bridge of ethical conduct or discipline. not harming others is a, I would call a kind of informal practice. Of course, all these informal practices we bring into a one-day sitting, but they're like daily life practices. And this ethical conduct, you know, it's the Bodhisattva precepts. So in our interactions of body, speech, and mind with others, trying not to harm. But when I contemplate non-harming, I think in the modern world, modern American world, in addition to our one-on-one interactions, we also have, it's a complicated world we live in compared to Buddha's time. So as consumers, this is the one way I think we can look at it in the modern world. How do we practice non-harm in the world of consumerism? We have to consume to live. And, you know, this has always been the case, but I think in modern times it's so easy to, like, just press a button to consume. We might not even notice we're doing it. And I mean, just like monetary transactions. Every time we spend a dollar, I would propose it has some effect, either harmful, helpful, or both. And often it's probably both. So it's not so clear cut. But it strikes me as this is an interesting way to look at ethical conduct in the modern world is, probably almost every day we're like spending dollars or swiping cards and to notice that this has effects no matter how small it is. We know more and more too about how the world is all connected, so it's very difficult, I think, to open to the vastness of this. You know, try not to. Maybe we don't want to support China and things made in China because of their political harm to Tibet, for example. But almost all electronics are made in China. You know, like for example, I try in general these days to avoid like plastic packaging, even though you can recycle plastic, supposedly. We don't know exactly really what happens to it. But like, I will actually pay extra for a glass container over plastic. And is that kind of silly? I don't know, maybe. But trying to think of like the implications, and it gets endless, reading the labels on things. And anyway, I just bring that up as a way to look at this, at ethical conduct or bodhisattva practice in the realm of non-harm, is how are we using our material resources to either help or harm the world. Like, we're going to do this cricket release ceremony this afternoon that I feel is like we're maybe saving the lives of these crickets. But it means buying them from a pet store. They're like basically, you know, the reptile food. So these particular crickets that we get today will not be reptile food, probably, depending on how many reptiles live around here. But and others will. And, you know, by paying the store for that, it means that they're going to order more of them because of that. We're kind of supporting them to get more reptile food in the form of crickets. So it's very complicated. Anyway, the third bodhisattva bridge practice is patience, forbearance, acceptance of painful situations, acceptance of discomfort and harm from others, and also acceptance of the Dharma teaching that nothing is really happening. This is a traditional breakdown of patience, paramita. So we might not have to worry about that if we haven't opened to this, to the fact that nothing arises and ceases. But if we start to approach that, it might be very disturbing to us. So this is included as a bodhisattva practice, is when we start to open to the truth that actually nothing is arising and ceasing, it might take a lot of patience to accept that and basically not freak out. So these three, giving, ethical conduct, and patience, today I would propose that they're kind of informal practices we can do all day long. They're great daily life practices. And the next three, called diligence or enthusiastic effort, is usually applied to the fifth one, which is meditative concentration, and that leads to wisdom or understanding of the full scope of reality. So those three kind of go together, and they're kind of like what we might call formal, like meditation practice. Again, I think you can bring diligence, you can apply it to the first three bridges, and you can be concentrated on what you're doing and open to prajnaparamita in the informal practice of daily life. But we have these opportunities like zazen and a one-day sitting to particularly focus on these last three: diligence or enthusiasm is kind of like when we start to get tired of sitting all day and the heat of the afternoon starts to set in, to just, I vow to continue with this practice for the whatever extent of this opportunity I set out to take part in today. And meditative concentration, dhyana, it's the Zen bridge. I recently listened to this TED talk. You know, TED talks, they're nice because they're kind of short. Snippets of what's going on in the world, kind of cutting edge in various fields. And this is a professor at Brown University who's working in the world of cognitive science, maybe neuroscience, and contemplative studies, which is kind of a new field, I think, related to what we do here in the Zendo. Looking at meditative practices and the effects of them through in different traditions. And so some of the studies that are being done are around happiness. There was this particular talk was about happiness, which is a kind of hard thing to assess, I think. I don't know how they judge happiness. It's such a subjective thing. If you ask someone if they're happy, what does it actually mean? But as apparently there's, I don't know all the details, but there's some kind of like scientific study around happiness. It's worth looking at, yeah? It's an important thing to us humans. So in this study, they found that the things that people often think are the primary causes of happiness actually aren't. And I think maybe all of us in this room have already heard this kind of thing or know it in our own experience. That, for example, living in the modern world with all its technology and everything doesn't necessarily bring happiness. Wealth is I think a really common one that even if we know it, we still kind of buy into it a little bit, that I think it does bring some happiness. But however these studies work, they found that actually there's no correlation hardly any correlation between wealth and happiness. It's kind of a radical thing to discover, especially for non-practitioners. It's something that so much of the world takes for granted. Another part of this study is we're looking into the relationship between happiness and paying attention to what we're doing. And apparently part of this study was done by somebody made this iPhone app that got sent to people and would ask them throughout the day, just randomly, the phone would ring, and, are you paying attention to what you're doing now? And then the next question is, how are you feeling? Are you happy? Something like that. Again, I don't know all the details. And it, you know, but they apparently, it was a very wide-ranging study, and they found, lo and behold, that I think 50% of the time, around 50% of the time, people were not paying attention to what they were doing. I thought 50% is pretty good, actually. And again, I don't know the definitions of what paying attention means, right? There's a lot of range. You know, I'm multitasking, doing 10 different things, but I'm paying attention. But I think there's times when we can definitely tell we're focused on the task. Maybe it's also a body-mind connection. If our mind is aligned with our body, maybe they didn't say that, but I would say maybe that's part of what attention is. So half the time people are paying attention to what's actually happening in the present and half not. And it was found that when they're paying attention, they're happier. And that was found to be the primary cause of happiness in this study, is when people are like present with what they're doing as opposed to distracted. I thought, isn't that amazing? And a good proof of our the reasons for our practice. And I find it, I thought, is that true in my own life? I thought. And when I think of examples, I think, actually, it's quite true. I feel like when things are going really well for me is when I'm kind of slowing down, doing what I'm doing, and even if it's some simple activity, if there's a kind of ease of body and mind, whereas if it's maybe even a really interesting activity, but I'm kind of half in there and half trying to do something else and feel kind of rushed, I'm actually not really at ease, even if it's kind of interesting or exciting. And you may feel the same. Yes. Sure.
I'm thinking about discomfort and you know, different kinds of suffering in this context.
Mm-hmm.
And it also seems like that's when we bail, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we are engaged, when whatever's happening in our life is hard and uncomfortable, or and brings up, you know, feelings, physical feelings, mental distress, is when we're not actually doing what we're doing. Because we don't want, you know.
Yeah.
All of the picture.
Yeah.
But it's part of it.
Mm-hmm. We often look for distractions when we're not, we think we're not so into what we're doing.
I do.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's true.
Or an unpleasant task.
Yep.
You know, rather than, and it's part of practice, obviously, for us, is to, okay, let's just be.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And it does completely, you know, change our experience.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, that's when the practice, if we have a intentional conscious practice to do that. Like she mentioned, this professor in this study, that like even if you're just taking out the trash, was the example she mentioned, if you're doing that really like engaged and like, I'm taking out the trash now, you actually, they found that people are happy to do that if they're actually just taking out the trash, as opposed to like, let's do it so I can get back to the TV show or whatever. Then it's like not a happy thing to take out the trash. It's like it's a burden. So I think exactly that's where our practice comes in, is can we actually just take out the trash when we're taking out the trash? Yes.
I've been really enjoying the book you've recommended to me, Being Upright.
Oh, yeah.
This book, who talks just about that, about being upright and really being present completely in everything you're doing. And that's been really helpful when I remember to do that. It makes a real change, it's a little shift to really giving my all to the smallest things and noticing when I'm not standing straight or when I'm not quite there and noticing the difference. And then the difference when I really am centered and really am present, there is an increased feeling of
mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's also some kind of division between body and mind, or just internal kind of split when we're trying to do two things, or we're half-heartedly doing one thing, and then the other thing that we really maybe want to be doing, we're actually is also half-hearted because we're not doing that so much either. Yeah, I remember like in high school, I was really into listening to music, and I didn't really like to do my homework, but I had to do the homework. And I'm like, I can do the homework while I listen to music. And I still remember for years I would do this, and it really didn't work for me. Some people maybe.
You probably enjoyed the music.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And I'd be like, you know, a math problem or something. I'd just be like sitting there with the pencil. There'd be this underlying tension because I actually would, if I just put down the pencil, I could really, really fully enjoy the music. But I was like, well, I got to do the homework, but let's try to get the music in here too. And it would take like hours and hours to do something that should take 5 minutes. Ridiculous. And I could have done the 5 minute work like this and then listened to the music wholeheartedly. But, you know, maybe that's multitasking, but I think it's about the half-heartedness, or it's like about the division, the split. So I think of samadhi, which means one-pointedness, or like a oneness. Sometimes we say of mind and object, but we could say also the unity of ourself and our experience. When we are one with our experience, that's maybe a way of defining samadhi. Whereas if there's me and then my experience over here, or maybe several experiences that are we're not really separate from them, right? But we remove ourselves, we make this division, and then it's not so happy. Samadhi is kind of a happy or peaceful, buoyant, energetic, and peaceful realm. So this is what we can practice today, is the happiness of paying attention to what we're doing, which is this very simple activity. So you'd think it would be easy to do, but of course it's not so easy to pay attention to just sitting in this posture and this breath. And I find it helpful to think of these three aspects of zazen, or any kind of meditative concentration, of mindfulness, or attention, or awareness. Is the main thing. It's an aspect of the mind, it's a quality of the mind that's directed towards the object, the chosen object of awareness. And I think it's valuable to actually consciously choose a meditation object. Instead of, well, I'll just sit here and see what happens. There is that kind of thing too. But I think it gets kind of dispersing. So to, you know, we can change the object, but maybe for like a period of sitting, we can say, over a part of a period, but at least to be consciously notice that, okay, my intention now is to attend to the breath in the lower abdomen, for example. And then there's this aspect of the mind that's through intention, kind of decision to do that, and the intention to stay with that, we can continue with this mindfulness. So that's one of these three qualities, is mindfulness. I think we could also call attention or awareness of the object. Could be the breath. It could be the present moment. I would propose is an object of awareness. We're not really separate from it, but the mind can intentionally be directed towards the present moment. It's kind of a specific thing. It might sound kind of like, it is kind of big, but it has boundaries, actually. The boundaries of the present moment and at the past and the future, those are not included. So it's kind of a specific thing. My object is the present. It's quite vast. It includes all the senses. Thoughts can come up in it. But any thought that's starting to veer into past memories or future expectations and plans, that's when we're like, oh, okay, we've left that. Let's return to this field of the present. So that's one quality. Another quality of mind that works closely with this is like vigilance or watching carefully the mindfulness. So it's like they're like a team. The mindfulness is the basic attention to the object, and then this other factor sort of on the side is like paying attention to the mindfulness, and like, oh, wake up over there, you're veering into the future. So I think in Pali it's sati sampajana. They're often mentioned as a pair. Sati is like the mindfulness, and then the sampajana is like a vigilant, maybe we say, you could even say diligence, alertness, I think would be a good word for it. Mindfulness is quite settled, just attending, but this is like, it can get kind of maybe dull and start to veer off into the past and future, or off the breath, if that's the object. And the vigilance, or the, what was the word I just said?
Not awareness.
Alertness.
Alertness.
Alertness. Alertness. So it's kind of like, it's kind of staying, it's like being on guard. Is the sense I have. Like this is just this basic work of attending to the object, and this is like the guard that never sleeps. It's like kind of checking out the mindfulness. It's a way of talking in the old meditation text. I think people could look into their minds and see there's this aspect of mind. It's kind of like off on the side that's like alertly attending to the mindfulness. And then the third quality is relaxation, because this, you know, if this guard gets too uptight, like don't wander, then the whole thing becomes too tense. Like, so we have to stay really relaxed. Maybe it's a third person. Maybe they're like three people in the mind. One's just my job is very simple, just attend to the object. But I'm quite relaxed, so I might forget. So this guard is going to say, oh, don't forget. And then this relaxed one is saying to the guard, just don't get too uptight there about this too. Like, now you relax. And this one says, no, but stay alert. And the mindfulness is maybe kind of in the middle. Just, I'm just doing my job. And I think we can sense these three aspects in our mind during Zazen. And it's like tuning. It's like a fine tuning. If if one of them is not working, then it gets unbalanced. Any one of the three. Yeah. Like, if the relaxed one's not working, things get too constricted and tight. We really, relaxation is such a key thing, which means the body and the breath are really settled. Even if there's discomfort, we can really settle into it. If we're just really super relaxed, but without that alert, vigilant watcher, then we tend to space out. Maybe the most common thing. Really relaxed and quite calm and settled, but the mind is starting to slowly drift into something else. We don't even notice it. One Tibetan teacher that talks about like the undercurrent. He says it's like when you're watching like the news on TV, like CNN news, and there's somebody talking on the screen that's giving you the news, but then underneath there's this runner kind of trailer thing with this other news going on. Which is a funny thing that it's part of our culture, I think, that we do things like this, right? You're listening to this news and you're also trying to read this news. It's like the highlights or something down here. That's how our minds are being trained in the modern world. But this is kind of like in meditation, the newscaster is maybe like the breath, or the object of meditation. But then there's this underlying commentary going on that, you know, you're somewhat aware of, but you don't even really know is happening. And it has a different story than the breath. And that's the one where, like, don't read that stuff if you're paying attention to the newscast. Yes?
You can go one step further and step back from that, using Joko Beck's model of a bigger container, and watch the newscast and the commentary underneath it, and watch them both at the same time without being caught by either or both.
Yeah.
And just keep stepping back.
A bigger container. Which often takes, you know, I think in a one-day sitting, is the prime time for entering a bigger container.
Yeah.
It's hard. I think if we enter it too fast, then we get dispersed and we're multitasking.
Yeah.
But I think it's true that if we're already have these three going, if we're already quite attentive and alert and relaxed,
yeah,
we can actually widen the container.
Without getting caught
or distracted. Yeah, yeah. The great Korean Zen teacher Sungsan Sunim one time was having breakfast and reading the newspaper at the same time and also talking to someone. Maybe one of his students was there and said, "You always talk about just you know, doing one thing and paying attention to what you're doing. You know, why are you doing these three things at once?" And he said, "Actually, I'm out just doing one thing called having breakfast while reading the paper and talking to you." So I think that's the same idea. It's a bigger container.
That's called multitasking. We're multitasking.
Maybe possible to multitask in a way that's balanced and not distracted, not divided. I think this thing, again, samadhi is like this unity. So if we feel divided, and I know that feeling of like this doing, as the high school student, doing the homework and listening to the music, maybe there's a way to do that, but it wasn't the case for me. It felt divided. It felt like not wholehearted. I'm doing this kind of half-hearted, and I feel not so good about it. And I'm doing this half-hearted, not so good about it. So all this is challenging, and it's a training. And then wisdom, prajna paramita, the wisdom bridge, is, I think, very similar to this meditative concentration. In the Zen world, it's not about something that you... It's maybe helped by things that you learn and hear about, but the direct experience of prajnaparamita is you're becoming more and more unified, less and less separation between you and your experience, Now, when there's no separation between you and your experience, tentatively, maybe we could call that prajnaparamita. How many people are going to be here for the cricket release at 5 p.m.? Oh, a few, so maybe I'll just mention briefly about that because it's something unique, maybe an annual event would do. So maybe kind of like the giving bridge, the first bodhisattva practice of generosity, giving life to these crickets. So it's a traditional ceremony in all, maybe Mahayana Buddhism, of releasing animals that are destined to be killed. So they often are bought from fishermen or bird sellers or cricket stores. And sometimes in mass quantities, I've seen and heard about these, you know, sometimes it's like a fishing boat with just, you know, thousands and thousands of fish, lots of people support. And actually, Pema Chodron in Nova Scotia does an annual lobster release. So that's lobster territory. And they support the local lobstermen. They buy all the lobsters, but then they put them back into the water. So, and this is from the Soto Zen ceremony book. So it's part of our tradition, although very rarely done in America, I think. And it's based on this one, the Golden Light Sutra, that talks about the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha's recounting one of his past lives as this bodhisattva who finds all these fish in a like drying pond. The water's all dried up because of drought, and he's trying to save them. So he goes and like gets all these people to help bring buckets of water from another river to help them. And then in the end, it's like he can't bring enough water. So, but he extends their life a little bit. And he says that there's this Buddha, Ratnashikin Tathagata Buddha, who... who made a vow that in the future, if people hear his name, they will be born in this peaceful realm. So he recites the name of Ratnashikin Tathagata for these fish. This is, you know, old Indian stuff, but that's part of the ceremony, is we recite Ratnashikin Tathagata's name for the crickets. But we also have in the Brahmajala Sutra, which is the source of our bodhisattva precepts. Our 10 major bodhisattva precepts come from this Brahmajala Mahayana Sutra. And in Soto Zen, from Dogen's time onward, to simplify and streamline the precepts, we just have those 10 major precepts from the sutra. But there's also 48 minor bodhisattva precepts in the sutra that are, I think sometimes in Soto Zen they're brought up, like we have our full moon ceremony, like called in Japanese called Ryaku Fusats. Fusats is Uposatha, which is the ancient Buddha's full moon ceremony, and Ryaku means abbreviated. So our full moon ceremony is the standard monthly thing, is abbreviated precepts renewal ceremony. But there's a Dai Fusatsu, the big precepts renewal ceremony that they maybe do once a year or something in Japan, where they bring up the 48 minor bodhisattva precepts too. So they're kind of peripherally in our lineage and tradition. One of these minor bodhisattva precepts, number 20, is not failing to liberate sentient beings. And the precept goes, a disciple of the Buddha should have a mind of compassion and cultivate the practice of liberating sentient beings. She must reflect thus. Throughout eons of time, all sentient beings have been my father and mother. I was born of them, so now if I slaughter them, I would be slaughtering my parents, as well as eating flesh that was once my own. This is so because all elemental earth, water, fire, and air have previously been part of my body, part of my substance. I must therefore always cultivate the practice of liberating sentient beings and enjoin others to do likewise, as sentient beings are forever reborn again and again, lifetime after lifetime. If a bodhisattva sees an animal on the verge of being killed, she must devise a way to rescue and protect it, helping it to escape suffering and death. So that's part of the context for the ceremony too. And so it involves the idea of rebirth. And it's always a question in modern American Buddhism. Some people don't go for the rebirth story. The classical teaching that we come back again and again, but I find it's interesting that one of the ways that teaching of coming back again and again gets used in Mahayana Buddhism is around compassion practices. So, like this is one example, but also just when we're cultivating compassion for others, one of the kind of techniques as a training that's often mentioned is to see everybody, all of us in this room, as having been our parents in past lives. So if there is rebirth, and it's gone on for infinite beginningless time, then that would be true, right? Chances are that we've all, just law of averages, we've all been each other's parents and children and relatives and friends and all, every possible type of relationship we've had just because there's so much opportunity. So I think it's interesting, and I wondered, can we work that one without the rebirth story? I've been thinking about that recently. It'd be nice if we could, because it's kind of a leap. Do we have to believe that we've had those relationships? And I think we could maybe work it just by saying that even if we haven't had those relationships, we've all been related. And as this sutra says, the elements, earth, wind, fire, and water, we're all made of the same stuff. I think from a kind of scientific point of view, materially, we're the same stuff as our ancient ancestors and our future generations. And everybody affects everybody from beginningless time. So we have that kind of cause and effect, intimacy and interaction. But it's kind of an awesome thing to contemplate the possibility that if there's this cyclical rebirth or there's particular karmic streams. There's no independent self, but there's streams of cause and effect of individual beings that are born and die and so on. Shakyamuni Buddha did teach this. If that was the case, then to like look at each other and think, wow, you were my mother? We had that kind of relationship? It's kind of awesome. It's almost hard to do, right? Because it's so almost excruciatingly intimate. I'm like, well, you don't seem like my mother. But like you cared for me so kindly in the past. And that's the reason for choosing mothers, even though people might have trouble with their mothers. They did in our early years especially. Care for us. So to remember that care and the idea in this mind training is like you're almost like you're paying back. It's based on the principle of like if you're really cared for, then naturally you care for others. It's kind of like that psychological truth, it seems like, was discovered a long time ago in ancient India. And the more we feel that we're cared for, the more we naturally want to care for others. So I think that principle is good to remember too, regardless of rebirth. So anyway, well, maybe when we see these crickets later this afternoon, think, wow, Mom, you've changed. But to somehow, maybe it's this ridiculous imagination, overly creative ancient Buddhists coming up with such stuff. But to just try on such imaginations, we can feel like in our heart, there's something there, you know, wow. That crunchy little body of this cricket is, you know, fed me when I couldn't feed myself. Not exactly that crunchy body, but some deep, some very tangible connection. So, all life is sacred, mysterious, and wondrous. Especially the miracle of consciousness is unspeakable, very mysterious. And you can see it in crickets for sure, right? So it's more like out of awe and respect for that. We don't know what's going to happen to your life after this, but let's release you for now. So we can talk more this afternoon at tea for those who are around. We offer any positive energy arising in this room today to all living beings everywhere. May they be released from all discomfort and stress and become one with their experience. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.